I was taken by a photograph of you.
Welcome to a special edition of Between the Covers, KBOO's program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Whitney Otto, author of the new book, Art for the Ladylike, an autobiography through other lives from Ohio State University Press. Whitney is the author of five novels, How to Make an American Quilt, a New York Times bestseller, which was adapted into a 1995 feature film produced by Steven Spielberg, Now You See Her, which was nominated for an Oregon Book Award and also optioned for film, The Passion Dream Book, an LA Times bestseller, also optioned for film, a collection of beauties at the height of their popularity, which was a Multnomah County Library selection, and Eight Girls Taking Pictures, which came out in 2012 and is somewhat of a companion piece to Whitney's new book. Whitney's novels have been published in 14 languages, and her work has appeared in anthologies and magazines, as well as the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, and the Oregonian. Her visual art was featured at the Littman and White Galleries here in Portland in 2006. In the words of Diana Abu Jaber, Art for the Ladylike is a fearless, free-range narrative that investigates parenting, class, sexuality, and worlds beyond. Startling, funny, and compassionate, this is an invaluable guide to the life of the mind and the soul of an artist. Whitney joined us via Zoom from her home in Portland. Well, Whitney, thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you for having me, Ken. I'm very happy to be here.
Now, the new book is titled Art for the Ladylike, an autobiography through other lives. You write in the book that you started it in 2002, but quote, I wasn't always sure what I was writing until I understood it as autobiography, that we are the things we love. How'd you come to that understanding, and why was that the key?
This is going to be not that interesting, so I'll try and keep it really tight. In the late 1990s, when, of course, everyone was doing memoir, and I thought, I'm not really a memoirist, I started this project called The Memoir Thing. And I won't go into what it is, but it was not a straight memoir because I thought that's just not going to be what I would write. Anyways, and then I went forward a little bit into the early aughts. And I had been thinking, the 1990 project can't happen this way because I was at this sort of impasse in my professional life. And I was thinking, I don't know how to pull it all together, like family and friends and career and art and impulses and all this. And so when I was doing the 1990 book, I realized a lot of the people in there were these women photographers. So that sort of, you know, transitioned into this other thing. And when I looked at it, the first thing I thought, I'm going to look to my heroes and see how they did it. So almost like using their lives as sort of like a little guide map or how-to book or something. But then I realized that they were my autobiography because they influenced me. I loved them. I saw them as, you know, forerunners to the creative life for women and how to pull it all together. And I think also because a lot of times you can't be George O'Keefe and say, well, I'm just going to go to the desert now. I mean, you have kids or you have other things. You can't just run off or say, you know what, I'm just going to spend the day, you know, high on heroin and do everything else in my life. So I remember looking at women and being interested in the art they did, but also in how they made that art and how they could make that art and how they had lives that weren't just about art. That's a long-winded answer.
Oh, no. And we'll go into that. I have several questions, including one about Georgia O'Keeffe. But we talked again about the subtitle, An Autobiography Through Other Lives. Why'd you choose the main title, Art for the Ladylike?
I think the idea of acting like a lady or being ladylike, especially when I was growing up, it was like, you know, that's not ladylike. And so I think it's kind of a funny word, and it's a sense of, it's like a wink and a nod kind of thing, obviously, you know.
Yes, that term lady is loaded.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like when I wrote Eight Girls Taking Pictures, I was asked, like, why not women? You know, why girls? And I thought, because being called a girl is, it kind of diminishes you a little bit. It sort of dismisses your achievements because, you know, you throw a ball good for a girl, that kind of thing. And so it just seemed like it fit. Now, when I did that book, I didn't realize there were going to be a whole bunch of books coming out like right before mine and right around the same time that also had girl in the title.
Yes, there was a time when people were trying to take the word girl, maybe add an extra R and some L's to it and turn it into something other than something derogatory.
Exactly. But I'd written that book also that was started right. It was started right after this book. So they were kind of being written concurrently. So yeah, there's a lot of lag time, I think, between writing them and them coming out.
Now, in the book, you mentioned an art history teacher you had in college, Philip Leiter or Leiter?
Mr. Leiter.
Leiter. And you say that he brought these artists to life by putting their work in the context of historical events, commentary, quotes from the artists, other artists, critics. And you write, he built a narrative, and that narrative made it clear what he loved and that art was a living thing. Now, that seemed to be a model for you, a lesson you took to heart when writing Art for the Lady Like.
I mean, very much so, because he, you know, oh God, he was such a great teacher, I have to say. But he did. He showed us how art was integrated in his life from the time he was a young boy, you know, growing up back east. And that just fascinated me. And then also when he would show us pictures, he would talk about what was going on at the time, but he would do it. He kind of talked, as I say in the book, in this kind of beat inflected way. It was kind of like a, he kind of was a beat kind of guy in a way, but not in a way that you thought, ick, what's this guy doing? It seemed very natural to him in his era.
You describe him as very professional.
Not
really interacting with the students socially, but just in the classroom as their teacher.
Exactly. And he was very opinionated. Like, I don't know if he could teach today, because he was very clear about what he liked and what he didn't like and how he felt about people in the artist's lives as if he were there. And he was very involved in the art world himself, but, you know, as an editor and a critic, not as an artist. You know, he was like having a really great opinionated friend. And I like that. I mean, I like opinionated people because I find it interesting, but only if they can support their opinions in an intelligent way. If they're just like opinionated to be opinionated, I think, oh God, don't waste my time. But he was really interesting. I mean, he made it really clear the reasons why for everything, which really intrigued me.
And I think you did the same thing in the book with making the art of these women photographers a living thing in the context of telling these stories, the narratives about their lives, and then kind of bringing your life into it as well. Now you're writing about photographers and their work, but you've said in an interview in the Oregonian, so this was back in 2012, I'm not a photographer, nor do I aspire to be one. I have a couple of vintage film cameras that I love because they are these gorgeous little machines and they're fun to use. I've never owned a digital camera. I have an iPhone now, though. I also like that photography is like writing, in that it can be a service for hire or an art form or both. And I love looking at pictures. So it makes me wonder why you haven't pursued photography as an art in addition to your writing, which is your primary art.
Yeah, you know, I don't know why. I mean, I do take pictures for myself, but mostly I'm sort of recording something rather than trying to make something.
As most of us take pictures, yeah.
Exactly. And so I don't know. I think it's just, I look around, I think so many people do it better. And I don't know. It just wasn't. And also the other thing I liked about photography is it is this kind of perfect melding of science and art too. I mean, it, you know.
Oh, right. Yeah. Technology and art. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I like that a lot. Now it's of course art and technology, which is also science, but I don't know. I loved it. I just loved it in that way that when you appreciate something, you love it. And this is the thing that I think is really funny about the era that we're in now. And don't write me any letters, but I think everyone wants to be the performer and no one wants to be the audience.
That's true with social media and podcasts and YouTube and TikTok and everything. Yeah.
And I love being the audience for movies. I love being the audience for photography. I love being the audience for paintings. There's such a pleasure, and as an audience, you're so important. I mean, the artist is nothing without the audience, really. I mean, you kind of have to have that. And so I feel like my position with photography is to be the lover and not the loved, I guess.
You're the designated audience.
Yeah, my designated audience.
Right. Now, there's several epigraphs for the book. There's one that really caught my attention. It was from Thomas Hardy's novel, Far From the Madding Crowd. I quote, "It is difficult for a woman to define her feelings in language, which is chiefly made by men to express theirs." So photography, as we mentioned, the science and the art, but it's a relatively new technology, certainly compared to print books, which go back hundreds and hundreds of years. And women have been involved in photography pretty much from the very beginning. Do you see photography as maybe a more democratic and less patriarchal medium, one not dominated by men as books are, or were certainly?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways, there were some really well-known women photographers even early on. But I do think a lot of times when people think about important photographers, maybe more recently, but I don't think a lot of women immediately came to mind. Like you always think, oh, it's Edward Weston or it's Alfred Stieglitz or something like that. But I do think that women have sort of taken the language of photography and made it their own. I mean, I really like when Mamie Vonda was talking about in her one of the lectures she gave in the early part of the 20th century about why women are better suited to work with color photography than men are. And she gives all these reasons for it, which I put in the book. And I really love that, where she's saying, okay, you know, we can sort of share this space, but just know that I've got strengths that you may not have. And I think that was a fair assessment. But
yeah, definitely these, most of the women photographers in the book, I had not heard of or heard of only briefly. So to tell their stories is quite a service. I learned so much. And on that subject, you write how women artists are treated differently than men, and not just photographers. Yeah. You say their priority is domestic, or at least that's the cultural expectation. And you give the example of, you know, one of the prime novelists right now, Jonathan Franzen. And he's praised, I guess he goes into an office where he blacks out the windows and puts on some soundproof headphones, noise reducing, whatever, blocks out the whole world while he's writing, even when he's writing domestic novels, which he does. It's a thread that runs through all the essays in the book, how a woman artist can balance the work with those cultural expectations.
Yeah, I think, and you... I mean, things are changing right now, as they always change in publishing. I mean, it just depends on what the right now is, but it is always sort of moving around and evolving. And I do think that, as I said, when I first started writing back in the last century, you know, I was always being asked about, are you married? Do you have kids? And of course, the subtext is, how do you do it? And I have a lot of male writer friends who, and this is the thing that's funny about that, is so many of them did half of the childcare in their relationships. They weren't like dads that were gone all the time, yet they still were never asked about it, as if it wasn't their primary responsibility. And so that's why I also talk in the book about sometimes you may dismiss domestic fiction, let's call it that, but you're not looking at what it takes to make the book at all. And sometimes, or the picture. So sometimes that is what I think the women are dealing with is, you know, look, I even got this done. Can you believe it? And so,
right. Yeah. And women are somewhat tasked with that domestic part, where men are considered, oh, boy, that's great that you change your kid's diaper. But of course, the woman is expected to do that all the time.
Oh, my God. Years and years ago, I was talking to a woman and she goes, well, no, you know, my husband's really great. I mean, you know, he does take care of he babysits the kids. That's what she said. He babysits the kids, you know, when I asked him to. And I was sitting there and I said, can I see your wallet? And then, you know, she goes, oh, okay. She has me a wallet. And I looked at the address. I said, what address does your husband live at? And she said, well, I said, is it the same address? And she's like, oh yeah. And I said, he's not babysitting the kids. He's not helping you with the house. He lives there. Those are his children. I don't understand this. And yet it was so common. I mean, especially women in my group, I hate to say, to still, not always, but to still sort of say, oh, he helps with the house, he does the dishes, you know. And I do feel that when you're in a partnership with someone, I think it's actually good to to appreciate what they do, not just take it for granted, regardless of who does it. I mean, if someone does the dishes on Wednesday, just say thank you. I don't think that's a bad thing. But I think when it becomes one partner's job to just do it and not be thanked or acknowledged, and the other partner, when they do it, to always be thanked and acknowledged, I think then you get this like imbalance. I think everyone should be, you know, thanked, I guess.
Now, you mentioned George O'Keefe before, kind of the freedom that she had, but you have a quote early in the book that she wasn't like that when she was first starting out. She said, "I can't live where I want. I can't go where I want to go. I can't do what I want to. I can't even say what I want to. I decided I was a very stupid fool not to at least paint as I wanted to." So this was her her way of expressing herself freely, where she didn't feel she had other avenues of doing that, other ways to do that. And you add, "For now, this quote," this is you talking, "must suffice as the stated intention of this book of essays." Do you view your own writing as one of the few means you have to freely express yourself, to do what you want?
Yes, I think so. And with this book, when I started this book, as I said, it came out of this other thing in the late 1990s, but I was never really going to publish it. I mean, I never really thought about publishing it because I thought, who would want to read this? Who would care? You know, who would be interested in this? And so it was really something, and this sounds odd to say because writers do write for themselves, but this was something even more for me because I had, you know, I was a novelist and I mostly dealt with fiction. I wasn't a straight memoirist. I was never going to be a straight memoirist. I don't have a really interesting life to be a straight memoirist over. I don't have something to overcome, you know? And, you know, I haven't done anything incredible with my life, like go to the edge of space. So, I kept thinking in terms of autobiography and the autobiographies that I really love. And the autobiographies I really love do tend to be a little left of center. They're not straight autobiography in that way. And so when I was writing this, I thought, I don't know what I'm writing. And as you can tell talking to me, I'm very digressive. And so I thought, this is going to be a really kind of digressive kind of conversation with myself. I really just wanted to spend time with things that I wanted to think about or that I loved or that I had an opinion about or and really not think that I was probably ever going to publish it.
You were doing it for you. Which is kind of having that control. Can you give any examples, Whitney, of some of those autobiographies you admire that you called left of center?
Well, I love the autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, which is written by Stein.
Gertrude Stein, yes.
it's so brilliant to think I'm going to talk endlessly about myself, but I'm not actually talking about myself because Alice is doing all the time. So it's so great. I love An Accidental Autobiography by Barbara Gerzudi Harrison, who of course was a big writer and feminist in her time. And hers is really interesting. She writes it, each chapter is groupings, like it'll be men and memento mori, or, you know, food, pictures and walls or something like that. And so the autobiography is very, very conversational and she just goes off and she keeps circling back. She'll move back. Like, it's not like she mentioned something in one chapter and now it's done. So I'm going to go to the next chapter. Done. It just keeps circling around and circling around, and circling around. And I love that. I love Marion Winnick did a couple of books and now they've been compiled in one. The first one I think was the Baltimore Book of the Dead. And so the one she's got most recently that compiled a couple of those books of the dead that she did is talking about all the people that she knew in her life that are now dead. Don't be friends with Marion Winnick. No, I'm kidding. No, I actually know her in real life, but anyways, but I love the way it's not quite like Spoon River Anthology or something. But what you get is this complete portrait of her, but done in this very episodic piecemeal way through these people that she knew in her life that are now dead, even if it was just a next door neighbor or if it was a grandparent. And then I love one of my very favorite is The Big C by Langston Hughes, I think. And it's all short pieces that are titled. And I think it came out when he was 40. So his life wasn't quite done, but it's so good. And it begins with this line about throwing all the books he takes all these books and he throws, he says something like melodramatic, it seems now, but throwing the books was like throwing a million bricks out of my heart. And you're thinking, who is this great poet who's throwing books in a river? Like, what is that? And then he comes back to it about 28 pages later of how he ends up doing that. So even though it's episodic, he's also, again, circling around and circling around. So those are
kind
just
of, kind of building on what he wrote before. And then, yeah, I love that style of writing.
Yeah, yeah. And
and you do a bit of that here in the book too, with your autobiographical parts, the way you see your life reflected in the lives of these great women photographers, and some of the subjects come up again and again.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to edge into their crowd.
All right.
Now, I'm at the outside of their house.
Now, we mentioned that you started writing this book in 2002. But you decided to turn your research into a novel, Eight Girls Taking Pictures, which came out in 2012. What went into that decision to go from this nonfiction? Again, maybe novels were something you felt more comfortable with because that's what you had written and published.
Well, I started out with the nonfiction because it came to this other project. Then after I started, I thought, oh, I could see the fictional possibilities here. So that's when I thought, I'm going to do two books like a diptych and draw on the same source material, but one will be a fictional handling of it and one will be nonfiction. And I started the nonfiction first, and I really thought that if I published it, if I did anything, that would be the thing that would be completed first. But as it was, I got going on the novel. And I mean, this book actually, like I said, in the first draft was probably done around 2003 or so. So what this book is pretty much what it was then. It is 40 pages shorter than what it was when I sold it. I took 40 pages out, but I don't think anyone would miss them.
Did you take one of the photographers out then, or, no. or just kind of, you just pared it down a bit?
Yeah, I just trimmed it down and I thought, oh, you know, I'm talking about this. That's not so interesting. I'm talking about this. Who cares about that? So I just some other sort of, you know, more conversational things. And there is some repetition in the book, I think, sometimes from essay to essay. But I took out a lot of repetition, but there is some that's still in there, partly because I didn't know if someone would read the book, you know, straight through or read them as individual essays. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's why that looks kind of like that.
Now, in the novel, Eight Girls Taking Pictures, you have, of course, the eight characters, the eight girls, mm-hmm. and six of them are based on women photographers that you talk about in your essays in the new book. Yeah. And you refer to the novel as a real mix of fact and invention. What was it like going from fictionalized portraits of these women, so kind of leaving out the invention part, to writing about them purely as nonfiction?
Well, with eight girls, six of them are based on these photographers. And then two of them, the photographers themselves are purely fictional, but the photographs they make are real. So Judy Dater and Sally Mann are not really in the novel, but their work is in the novel. And it was different in that I could talk more or talk in a different way about certain aspects of their lives. I had originally looked at this book as having four sections with two photographers in each section. And one section would be like, you know, motherhood and domesticity. One would be war and politics. I think it was sexuality and the nude, and then feminism and whimsy. I think those are my four categories. And so the reason why I don't consider this a biography, although it has biographical elements, is because I just wanted to use pieces of their lives. There were certain aspects of these women that I thought, that's what I want to talk about. Like with Lee Miller, I really wanted to talk about why I felt she was comfortable in a war zone, but I didn't want to talk about her whole life, which is amazing life, but
Up to a point.
Up to a point.
And then, yeah. After World War II, things seemed to kind of settle down a bit.
Very much so. Yeah. So,
Now, we should mention who the women photographers are, and in order of the sections of the book, the essays: Sally Mann, Imogen Cunningham, Judy Dater, Ruth Orkin, Tina Madotti, Lee Miller, Madame Yvonne, and Greta Stern. How did you choose the eight artists? And I was wondering, there's some more famous photographers, at least women photographers that I've heard of, like Margaret Bourke White, Dorothea Lange, Diane Arbus, for example. You left them out of the book.
Yeah, because they don't oh God, this is going to sound terrible, but they don't mean anything to me. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I can look at their work. I can look at Cindy Sherman or Nan Goldin or someone like that. And I think, or even more contemporary, whether it's like Carrie Ann Weems or, oh God, Lorna Simpson. But the work, I didn't want to write about photographers. I wanted to write about the creative life and women who are my heroes. And these were my heroes from the time I was pretty young. I mean, some of them when I got a little bit older, but some certainly even starting in college. And why they particularly interested me as my life went on, I don't know, except for it's a really personal selection in that way. So it's a difference between writing about women photographers and writing about women photographers that mean something to me or that have like a personal connection for me.
And that's important because it's the your autobiography through these other lives. So you'd have to see that connection. Now you mentioned your original order for the book with these four sections of two photographers each, and you ended up giving each one a separate essay, separate section in the book, but it's not in chronological order. How did you decide on the sequencing, especially in light, you talked about an early interest in architecture and form, I guess. So I was wondering how you went about structuring this book.
Well, okay, so when I did the novel basically spans the 20th century and goes into the 21st century. And it does have a chronology to it. And that seemed natural to it for me. But this book, the way that the photographers show up, it's a holdover from when they were in a category. So when I was looking at Motherhood and Domesticity, it was Sally Mann and Imogen Cunningham together. You know, it would be Lee Miller and Tina Modotti with War and Politics, or, you know, Sexuality in the Nude, you know, together. So they remained in their those four categories. So, and it's funny you mention that, because I did think after I said, I'm going to sell this, I thought, oh gosh, maybe I should redo it and put it in this kind of order. And instead I just left it the way it was. I mean, a lot of the things with this book, because I wrote it so long ago and then sold it so many years after, I kind of decided not to change what I didn't need to change. I mean, there were certain anachronisms in there I had to get rid of, and hopefully I got rid of all of them, but really I didn't add a lot and I didn't take out a lot. I left it. So it's kind of a snapshot, if you will, of my life at a certain time, more than something that's happening like right now.
Oh, it works. I didn't feel that it was any less because it wasn't in chronological order. I think it actually kind of added a lot because I mean, I didn't know about those original categories you put them in, but I guess subconsciously that was working for me as a reader. Now the women in the book, almost all of them, probably all of them, were overshadowed by their male companions. Mm-hmm. And some of them had relationships, platonic or otherwise, with several of the photographers in the book, Man Ray, Edward Weston, Alfred Stieglitz, Ansel Adams, Diego Rivera, Picasso even. So even when the woman's artist work was comparable, if not greater than the man's, it was hard to step out of those shadows. And that seemed to be definitely one of the recurring themes in the work. Maybe one of the reasons why you chose these artists or why you connected with them.
I'm probably why I ended up discovering some of them. I mean, certainly I discovered Lee Miller through Man Ray, and I was in college. I don't know, I was like 20 maybe. And I was really getting into Man Ray, and I kept seeing this woman that would show up over and over. And as I say in the book, I didn't know until, oh my God, way later that she was a photographer in her own right. I just thought she was his assistant and she helped him discover solarization and she was a model. I just didn't know. And then other ones like Tina Modotti, I would see her image over and over. I think, well, who's this person? And then I would discover, oh, she was with Weston. So she didn't come through Weston. I think if you think of the world creatively, there's a real, at least for me, a real pushback to see anything through a really specific lens and only through that lens. I mean, certainly this book is about women and feminism and what it takes to be, you know, creative and everything. But the other thing I liked about these women is they love their children. You know, they love their partners. At the same time, their children and their partners could also be a burden. And they also really love like these male artists, and these male artists on some level celebrate them. I mean, I think it's a shame when we try and take art and categorize it, like you can only like this, you can only like that. Or the other thing related to this is I can't stand it when someone is critiquing a piece of art strictly through a lens, like, well, I don't like that because that's done by a white male director. And I think, okay, but why don't you like the movie? Because you can not like the movie. You can dislike anything you want. But it's like I was talking earlier about liking people that are opinionated. I want to hear your opinion, but I want to hear how you arrive at that opinion. I want that conversation. And so when something is reduced to, oh, I don't like the way it depicts fill in the blank, I sit there and I think, do you understand that art that is at the service of either celebrating something or educating you on something is just propaganda? That's not really art exactly. And the other thing too is the people that make this stuff that you enjoy are going to have really thorny personalities. There's no
yes, very that. Flawed. I mean, you know,
artists
especially.
Artist has ever been a straight line, yeah. And so, you know, we have this recent expectation of we want our artists to be pure in some way. And I think then, honey, you got to spend some time around some people who are creative because sure they ain't. And I think, and we want the art to do something. And you can have art that celebrates things. Sure, of course, you know, you can have civic art. You can have all kinds of art. But I mean, even some of that Soviet art is pretty cool looking now. And that was certainly at the service of the state in the 1930s or whenever they were making it. But this is not my era, I think, in that way. Because, you know, I mean, I can love something. I think I mentioned the book about Man Ray. I mean, there is something really awful that probably is true about him. I don't like it any more than anyone else likes it. But what am I going to do?
You mentioned that about Picasso, too.
Yeah.
not a real role model for the rest of us.
Oh, my God. Well, you know,
what a great artist.
Oh, yeah. I was watching... oh God, it was a Hannah Gadsby, Nanette, and she started going on.
Oh yes,
Which is a great, I mean, I think it's a terrific show that she put on. But when she starts talking about Picasso, when asshole he is, I thought, duh. I mean, I was taking art history in the mid 70s, and my teacher, Mr. Leader, who loved Picasso, was very clear about what a jerk he was and what he was like with women. And you know, the kind of person that he was. I mean, it was not a secret. It was not like, and maybe that's the difference with the generations. It's like, I knew, and I'm not saying people should always separate the art and the artist, because I know that's a thing now. I'm just saying that maybe that's not my inclination.
I agree with you. And I've had discussions with friends about that as recently as Woody Allen.
Right.
Who also is not exactly a role model, and there's a lot of despicable things that he's done, but I love a lot of his movies. I think it'd be difficult to argue that he's not a great filmmaker, and certainly a very funny one at times. But I totally understand why people might not want to see his movies, because it brings up connotations of the way he is like as a human being, which is, again, not all that respectable.
Well, no, and I think you're exactly right with that. And I mean, I think also it's really funny that a lot of people seem very comfortable about kicking him around now. And I think, yeah, well, his movies are not very good right now. They haven't been good for a long time.
He's been in decline for a long time. He makes a movie a year, and he's getting on in age, and a lot of them are repetitive and just doesn't seem to put much work or time into them.
No, so if you're saying, oh, I don't like Woody Allen, I think, yeah, well, I don't like those movies either. I was talking to someone recently who's more conservative than I, and I was saying, you know, there are these political figures on your party. They're not smart. I mean, and they're cruel on top of everything, which is always a bad combination, as we know historically. I said, now there are other people in your party. I do not like them, but they are smart. I mean, I can't deny their intelligence. I don't like their politics. I don't like what they do with their intelligence. I don't like it, but I'm not going to sit there and say, you're an idiot. I mean, if I'm calling someone an idiot, I truly mean it. I don't mean it because I don't like their politics. And I feel that way with, you know, like we were talking about with Woody Allen. It's like, regardless, he was, you know, a pretty terrific filmmaker.
And, but some of those flaws have helped you with your autobiography in this book. One example is the photographer Imogen Cunningham. She was married to Roy Partridge, and he was very possessive, very selfish. Eventually led to their divorce when she insisted on moving to New York for her career and he didn't want her to move. And you write in the book that it helped you understand your own relationship with a boyfriend you had in college.
Yeah. And I think when you have that kind of relationship, you could spend your life hating somebody and thinking, you did this to me. And I'm lucky. I've never had like the really horrible abuses that I know a lot of women have suffered. But even today, I look at him and I think there were things I can't go back and get that I could have had when I was with you and didn't get to have those things. But I don't hate you. You know, I don't, you know, you're just who you are. And I was too young to not see that I didn't have to put up with it or anything like that. And so when I look at like Imogen, I really understand a little bit about her relationship because of my relationship because of her relationship. And it's never so simple, I think. Well, no, I shouldn't say never. It's seldom so simple to just say, oh, well, I'm just going to go. I'm just going to leave. If you do that, you know, people don't really act like that. I mean, they put up with a lot or they try and work around a lot. And I would imagine with Roy, I mean, she found herself with three kids in a certain era. What was she going to do? And my understanding is they didn't get along that well for a long time. But as I say in the book, you know, being selfish doesn't make you a bad person. You're just a selfish person. You know, I mean, you're not like a monster. You're just.
Oh no, he wasn't a monster. Yeah. From what you write in the book. No, but yeah. It was just, I was just trying to get at how the autobiography plays into the actual lives and relationships of the artists, the women photographers that you write about.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you know, like with Imogen, I mean, like with when I read about Roy, I think, how did you even marry this guy to begin with? And then I look at my life, I think, hey, how did you end up living with this guy? You know,
I think that's happened to all of us.
It's kind of a funny thing. You see what they can't see. But yeah, I mean, I don't think I could stand him for 5 minutes. I think it'd be a pretty big challenge.
Exactly. Now, I want to get to another artist in the book, Judy Dater. She was born in 1941, and she's perhaps best known for the photograph Imogen Cunningham and Cuenca at Yosemite, which was taken in 1974. And it happened to be the first adult full frontal nude photograph published in Life magazine. And it shows Imogen Cunningham, very old, almost looking like kind of a Russian babushka, and a very young and naked and beautiful Cuenca Tebow. And they're standing in front of a huge tree, of course, at Yosemite National Park. Now, you write in the book that you actually met both Judy Dater and Cuenca, though on separate occasions.
Yeah.
Can you tell us those stories? Maybe first your run-in with Judy Dater.
Well, I was living at the beach, you know, on Balboa Peninsula in college. And I'd gone down to this gallery and it was a Judy Dater show. And this was just like a local gallery. It wasn't any kind of big deal. And I saw the picture and I thought, oh my God, I love this. And they gave out this, you know, the free postcard and everything. And of course I was broke because I was in college and working my way through. And so I had it and I put it on the wall. And I just loved it, you know, all the time. I love this picture. And then we ended up moving to San Francisco, John and I. And then I went back to graduate school and then we went back to San Francisco. And so I was at this party at my ex-professor's house up on Russian Hill. And I was in his office and I saw this picture. I said, oh my God, that's a Judy Dater. And it was this great picture. And I said, I love her work. Because by that time I had seen other pictures of hers that I really loved. And he said, oh, well, she's going to be at this party tonight. Oh my God, I can't believe she's going to be here. And he was also an author and his wife was a photographer. And it was a very small house they had. It wasn't like this, you know, I mean, you were like up on each other. So I was so nervous she was going to be there. I was really excited she was going to be there after all these years. Because it had probably been, I'm trying to think how old I was, maybe like 15 years since I first saw her work in the gallery. And so she comes in, she's with someone else. And my host introduces us. And I said, oh my God, you know, I said, I'm so nervous to meet you. And I love your work. And she's like, uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. And then I told her about the picture. I said, well, it was just a postcard. turns around and walks away. It was like, I'm done with you now.
She went right. off mingling.
Yeah, I was like, oh, you're not a paying customer. But yeah, but it was kind of funny. I'm just kind of standing there and I thought, I still love your work. Again, an example of the artist and the art, I thought.
Oh, right. The person versus the artist. Yeah. Yeah, and Twinka, you met in 1991 in Portland. Right here.
Yeah, so we have up here. Yeah, and there used to be a gallery. Did you ever know S.K. Josephsberg? It was in the Pearl.
Oh, I've heard the name, yes.
Okay. So he had this great gallery, and he handled photographers. So we were in there. We'd gone to one of the shows that he had put up, and we were buying a picture, and the woman who was helping us, you know, was taking our money and, you know, doing all her thing and everything. Very, very nice. And then she said, well, just ask for me, Twinka. Well, it's such an unusual name. And of course, and that made me really see her because this is decades, right? And I really saw her and I said, oh my God, I can't believe it's you. And yeah, and so she lives here in Portland and she's my Facebook friend, actually.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I looked her up. She still lives here. She's mm-hmm. in her 70s now. I was wondering, besides Facebook, have you ever met up with her again and talk with her?
You know, I only met her at the gallery. And I don't think we met again. I've become friends with Stephen Josephsberg and his wife, Susan Subert, who's also a professional photographer. But no, I mean, I haven't really, no, we're just mostly Facebook friends. But it just seemed weird to me that my life is like Judy Dater, Judy Dater, Judy Dater, all the way up the coast, you know?
In the book's essay on Sally Mann, you write, a work of art always says as much about the viewer as it does about the artist. When I look at that photograph, Imogen and Twinka at Yosemite, my eyes are drawn from the much older Imogen and towards the very beautiful young naked Twinka, somewhat as a voyeur, you know, kind of the male gaze. How do you view the photograph as a woman and an artist yourself? And I was wondering how you feel, you know, the fact that a woman took the picture, Judy Dater, how that would differ from if a man had taken the same picture. The kind of effect, the expressions they would have gotten.
You know, it's funny because, as I said, I was so young. I was in college when I first saw the image. I mean, I think your eye is drawn to Twinka more than Imogen, but as you look at it more, you know, you'll start to sort of, you know, drift over to the left. And I remember I had a male friend that was over. Not that kind of friend, but anyways, he had seen the picture. And I said, I know. And I said something about Imogen. I said, doesn't she look great? He said, you're not a man, are you? Okay, I got it. And so I don't know, but I think that, like, it is voyeuristic. And it did take me until I was a lot older to kind of see the tension between youth and age. And
there's so much in there.
Yeah. And
what a great picture.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, and I don't know if a man, you know, certainly Judy Dater and her then boyfriend / eventual ex-husband, Jack Wellpott, did that project, Women in Other Visions, where they did photograph the same woman, and gave their interpretation of it in the 70s, or early 70s. And I think her pictures are a little bit better, but would I be able to actually tell? I mean, maybe if I really studied them, I would think, well, it looks like a woman took this and a man took this. But once you know who took them, it becomes more evident, I think, you know.
Oh, definitely. People might react differently if they knew a man took the picture instead of a woman like Judy Dater.
Yeah. And it is weird. I mean, I know that there's been kind of anecdotal history anyways of male photographers liking very young girls or
Edward Weston.
There's a few of them in there. Uh-huh. And they, and of course you think, well, yeah, I mean, in a really weird way, taking the body of say a 15-year-old girl certainly is a lot easier, I'm guessing, than taking the body of, you know, a 55-year-old woman. You know, I mean, it's not aesthetically, there's something that to me that seems just very easy about, you know, that young, perfect body. So I know that there's, you know, there's some of that that goes on. And I don't think women photographers have that same thing. So I think with women photographers, maybe their view of people is, maybe, I don't know this, maybe it's more expansive in a way. Maybe they look or they find different things, you know, or in the landscape or in objects or something like that. I think it's interesting, Cindy Sherman, she takes herself, you know, but she makes herself different characters.
Oh, right. Yeah. And then on that subject, just a little bit more about Sally Mann. She had a photographic series about her own family, yeah, including her children, called Immediate Family. And you write in the book that this series, and I quote, in a very fundamental sense, defined motherhood for me. And I wonder what you got out of that series, how it defined motherhood for you. What effect did motherhood have on your writing and on your own art?
It made me see that it took the sentimentality out of having kids, which I really liked. And so the kids were beautiful. The situations were not always beautiful, but there was something obviously very art-like about it, but also very sort of real about it. And that really helped me think about being a mother and kids. But the other thing was, she was a mother who was making art while she was home with kids. And that was the other thing that resonated with me, as I thought, oh, you can do this. You
know? Yes, it's possible. it's difficult, but possible, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love those pictures so much. And I know she's got a memoir that came out several years ago, but I never read it until after I finished this book, because I wanted just what I already knew of Sally Mann from a long time ago, you know, how I felt about her then. I didn't want it colored by anything, you know, after that, really.
All these stories are just amazing. And again, I haven't heard of many of the artists in the book or just very briefly. But I want to talk a little bit about Ruth Orkin. Such a full, productive, and fascinating life. She was 18 in 1939, and apparently she bicycled across the country on her own from where she lived in Los Angeles to the New York World's Fair. She worked in advertising in the 60s, the Mad Men era, and you have some parallels to your mother's career. She took a series of photographs when she was living in New York, a 15-floor apartment on Central Park West, and that series is called A World Through My Window. And she also did portraits, photo portraits of some famous celebrities, Einstein, Hitchcock, even Woody Allen, who we were talking about. How do you see yourself reflected in her amazing life, especially how she balanced all these experiences and adventures with motherhood, kind of like you were talking about? You could be a mother and make art at the same time.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, Ruth Orkin, and this is her in September, I think her birthday is like September 3rd, but she would be 100 years old if she was alive today, uh-huh, her centennial. And she did incredible street photography too. I mean, people start thinking now more about Vivian Maier, but she was sort of the pre-Vivian Maier in a way, although, I mean, some of what they did was kind of overlapped, but she's a little earlier. I think with her, again, it was the idea that you could be home. I mean, she was kind of clear, like, I am stuck at home. It wasn't like she said, oh, you know what? Can't wait to be home and can't wait to be in this apartment. And yet she made art out of it. And I think it's a kind of a lesson of, you know, you can make art out of almost anything, but you do have to have the skill for it. I mean, I'm not talking about like a DIY kind of thing. And she had made a movie with her husband and this other man, which got nominated for an Oscar, and that Francois Truffaut said kicked off French New Wave.
Wow.
It's a terrific movie. And then the second one, which is my favorite one, she was only a screenwriter because by then she had a child. And then the third one, it was a trilogy and she didn't have anything to do with it at all. And the third one is my least favorite. I mean, even before I knew she didn't have anything to do with it. And she had her first child, I think, when she was 39. So she had two kids like at 39 and 41. Lee Miller had her first child at 40. I mean, sometimes, you know, even with Imogen Cunningham, she didn't get married until she was 29. And for her era, that's a little bit on the later side. So a lot of these women too have these lives. I mean, Imogen Cunningham had kind of an amazing life for where she came from. Certainly Lee Miller did. You know, so did Ruth Orkin. I mean, Ruth Orkin, she was also a ship's photographer. She did some work in Israel for a while. She was coming back through Europe when she took the really famous picture of Jinx Allen walking down the street in Florence. So that was the other thing that was interesting to me too, is that these women had these lives and then moved into this sort of domestic sphere. And that was kind of resonated with me as well, because I didn't have my son until I was 36. So, and then suddenly you're home. And so I think that really related for me. And also what related for me too was in terms of Imogen Cunningham, who said, hey, I took pictures of plants because that's where I was. I was in the and Ruth Orkin says, yeah, I took pictures out the window because that's where I was, you know. And so with those women too, it was really nice to see that, you know, they were still making art, but also they weren't saying, oh my God, this is such a great opportunity. Who knew I would take these beautiful botanicals because I was stuck at home with three kids. And, you know, it didn't have that kind of, none of them had that kind of vibe about them. Like, oh, whatever you thought was bad turned out to be great. You know, they were like, yeah, I was home with the kids. And so, you know, so what the hell? And they ended up making doing some great stuff, all of them.
We mentioned Lee Miller. You called her the quintessential bad girl, and you kind of contrasted that with another photographer, Tina Modotti, who died tragically fairly young, about the age of 46. And you called her the good girl, which is not necessarily a good thing from what you said. Can you tell us a little bit to contrast Tina Modotti and Lee Miller, why one's the good girl, one's the bad girl?
Well, I think I used both of those, you know, terms pretty loosely. And I think the main difference between them, for me, it seemed like Tina Modotti comes across to us as someone who, I mean, she's very politically involved, but a semi-life of service in a sense, and, you know, in principle, and just, you know, and like she said at one point in this parlor game, Tina Modotti profession men, you know, she had, you know, various men that she was involved with who generally were in politics, not Edward Weston, certainly. But I think she was someone who said, okay, I'll do this. I'll, you know, come to my house, I'll feed you. Come to my house, I'll entertain you. You know, I'll model for you. I'll work in your, you know, gallery. You know, I'll do all these different things. Whereas Lee Miller always strikes me as someone who says, I'm not doing that. I'm doing this. Ask somebody else. And so I think that's why they, and yet they twin for me in that they both have some real similarities in their lives. And they were both considered great beauties. They both were the muses and assistants and students of very famous, very successful male photographers. They traveled out of their homes to other countries. They're very desirable. They fall apart though, both of them, really in their 30s. You know, they really, nothing goes the whole distance with them in a sense.
Yeah, Lee Miller lived a much longer life, but she did have that decline. And you mentioned, yeah, very beautiful as a young woman. She was painted by Picasso, filmed by Cocteau, photographed by Man Ray. But she did happen to also buck a catch-22 about women photographers, which you repeat several times throughout the book. The quote is, they tell you that the important pictures are taken on the battlefield, then ban you from the battlefield. Yeah. So it's a no-win situation for a woman. They weren't allowed to be combat photographers during World War II, but Lee Miller kind of stumbled into it. Can you tell us how that happened, how she ended up taking pictures of a battle between the Germans and the Allies in France?
She was living over in London with yet another man. She was married to this Egyptian businessman, but they didn't live together. He was in Egypt and she was living with this British man. And the war begins. Her parents wanted her to come back to the States. She didn't want to go. She stayed. And she was sort of filming. She was working for British Vogue, which is called Brogue. She's filming different things that are happening around, like land girls or people in the tube or things like that, because they certainly weren't going to send her over to be a combat photographer. Well, anyways, finally, she gets the opportunity to go over to the continent. She has her own uniforms made. I think they're really beautiful too. And she hops on a troop flight or whatever it is. And she goes over there and she ends up at San Malo. And I guess there was this, I don't know, whatever you call them, a group of German soldiers who, they didn't know the war was over, basically.
It was August 1944.
Yeah. And so they're still fighting. And so she took pictures and she said, you know, I became a combat photographer. Like, you know, she wanted to be one before, but she just couldn't be one. And so she ended up being one anyways. Yeah. Just very briefly.
And she also had some very fortunate timing a few months before that. And it resulted in a famous photograph. I wonder if you could tell us how she ended up getting her photo taken in Hitler's bathtub in Munich, just about the same time Hitler was committing suicide in a bunker in Berlin.
Yeah. So she's living in London, you know, with this man. And then there's also this young American. He was like a photojournalist named David Sherman. He's staying with them. And she, by this time, I want to say she's in her early 30s, maybe, or 30, 31, 32, whatever she is. And he's in his 20s. And they end up traveling together when they go over to the continent. And they are sort of semi-attached to, I don't know if you call them battalions, I don't know what you call them, regiment, I don't know, of American soldiers. And they're sort of following them around. And David Sherman is taking pictures. She's taking pictures too, but she's also writing these dispatches that she sends to Brogue. And that's how she ends up at Dachau. And that's how she ends up photographing burned out towns, women who are French collaborators. I mean, all these things. And then she kind of goes into Paris every once in a while and meets old friends and kind of goes back out again. And so one of their travels, they end up and they talk their way into Hitler's apartment. And so they're down there in Hitler's apartment. And the thing I love about it, I didn't write all about this. I mean, I wrote about it a little bit, but I didn't do the whole thing she said about the apartment. But basically she was saying the art was really shitty. It was very mediocre. And it looked like a rental that could be cleaned out in 5 minutes. I mean, it's like, it was so great the way she describes the apartment. But yeah, that sounds like Hitler. I mean, it's like him. Like, you don't love anything. You don't give a shit about anything, you know?
Right. Not a great sense of interior decoration.
Oh, my God. It was so, that was so funny. And so they took some pictures there. And one of them was of her in Hitler's bathtub, where she walked out the dirt of Dachau. And he was, and the phone was still live. He was committing suicide. Oh, they also went to Eva Braun's villa, too. She, if you go to the archive, which I haven't been to in England, although I've been invited, there is Nazi souvenirs that she picked up, but they never put them on display. Like if you have to get permission to see them, but she did pick up some things there and stuff that she brought back. And it's one thing that really kind of, I don't know, it was almost like this heartbreaking moment. I don't think I put it in the book though, where she talked about going to these burned out villages. And she said at one point, you know, she was in Germany and they're going through this village and she sees this elderly woman and she's in the street and she's so old and she's trying to pick up something. It's sad. And she said, and I went over to try and help her. And then I stopped and I stepped over her because she always hated everything German, anything related. And that was kind of it for her. When she saw what happened in the war, she just thought, even this elderly woman who's struggling and everything, I'm not doing anything for you.
Yeah, and that was a traumatic experience that kind of followed her the rest of her life and actually caused her kind of almost to withdraw from certainly the art world, from photography.
Yeah, so she, she always remained very angry about the war and everything. And
now, in that same section on Lee Miller, you write, one of the things that interested me about the female photographers in this book is the nature of the relationships with their respective fathers, the elemental, timeless connection that seems outside of age and gender. And Lee Miller had a particularly tragic childhood. You write she was raped at the age of 7. She contracted gonorrhea, which had a lot of complications. But oddly enough, she had generally a supportive, if somewhat unusual, relationship with her father. And you talk about your relationship with your father in the light of these father-daughter relationships in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it was so interesting to me that in reading about them and learning about them over the years, I realized all of a sudden at one point, I thought, God, there's not a lot about their mothers or their relationships with their mothers. I mean, they weren't particularly close to any of them, it seemed. I can't speak completely. Maybe they were closer than I think. But regardless, their fathers were the ones that were always really influential in their lives. I mean, even with Imogen Cunningham's father, he built her a darkroom and he's like, I don't know why I want to be a dirty photographer, but he did it anyways, you know? And then with Madame Yvonne's father, he said, he set her up in a studio. And Lee Miller's father, after the rape, her parents were very progressive and he said, well, we'll take you into Manhattan. They were living in Poughkeepsie. We'll take you into Manhattan and we'll, you know, take you to a psychiatrist and he's going to have you understand that love and sex are not the same thing, which is why she was sort of notoriously not jealous and very free with her body and didn't care.
Yeah, very open about sex and not possessive at all.
No, not at all. But I think the fathers, and she remained very, very close to her father throughout her life. And, you know, there's all kinds of you know, conjecture about how close that relationship was, because it was pretty damn close. Yeah. But it's one of those things again. And I think, and maybe it's the, well, as a person, I'm always sort of endlessly curious about things anyways, but for me, it seems plausible that she could have a relationship with her father that isn't, I don't know, a good idea. It is like too close. You know, I mean, they would travel together, you know, when she was an adult, and I don't know that they had separate rooms. I don't know what happened. And certainly he didn't have a lot of boundaries with her when she was in high school or with her friends. And he, you know, he was unfaithful in his marriage. So it wasn't like he was devoted to her mother in that way. But it seems plausible to me that she could have an intimate relationship with her father and still really love him and still feel close to him and still feel protected by him. I mean, who am I to say that she didn't, you know? And it wouldn't be my relationship with my dad. And I know that generally that's a damaging relationship, but you know, everyone's a little different, so.
Right, especially artists. Her, yeah. but actually it worked out for her no matter what. It seemed like one of the positive aspects of her life, which was, had some tragedies in it, namely that rape at the age of 7.
Yeah, and he was not possessive about her. It was not like if they did have some kind of intimate relationship, he still wasn't someone who said, oh, wait, you know, he wasn't like Humbert or something, you know.
Yeah. Or the accident, you mentioned the book Homo Faber, yeah, where a father accidentally has sex with his daughter.
Yeah,
he doesn't know it at the time because they've been out of touch, and so there is. You write a little bit about incest in the book without making any connections directly to Lee Miller's relationship with her father, because we don't really know.
Cornelius Ninn too. She's another one.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Now you write in
that's
the book.
That's going to be my next book.
No. Oh, is that? Okay.
I'm kidding.
Oh, because I actually have kind of a last question here about that. You write in the book that all of your novels can be distilled into three main subjects: women, art, and feminism. And you did a recent live stream event for Broadway Books here in Portland. Mm-hmm. You said you were currently working on a novel, so your next book that you started about 5 years ago, with that theme of art and women, and I would assume feminism too. Is there anything you could tell us about that book, or would you rather not? I know a lot of writers would rather not talk about what they're working on right now. It's almost like a curse.
Well, God, you know, this is the fifth summer since I began it, and it's still not anywhere close to being done. I mean, I have it mapped out sort of. I mean, I don't really use outlines or anything, but it is kind of in my head. I kind of understand how it should go, how it, you know, how the story should plug into the structure, but who knows? I don't know if it'll ever work out.
But you're back to fiction, it seems, from the essays and the nonfiction of Art for the Ladylike.
Well, I like doing the nonfiction because, you know, as you can tell, I'm very chatty and I have a lot of opinions. So, so nonfiction works for me, but it would have to have like a reason. I mean, like more of a structure. It'd be fun to just say, hey, this is what I think about this, this is what I think about that. But then again, we're in an era where sometimes I think maybe it's better that I'm not publishing anything of what I think.
Well, there's enough people who do all that on social media every day. Not worth putting in a book, I think, a lot of that stuff. Well, Whitney, I learned so much from the book, and you really shined a light on these great women photographers who are not written and talked about all that much. And yet I think they're great artists and they led fascinating lives. It was just entertaining and enlightening. And I want to thank you for talking with us about the book today.
Oh my God. Thank you, Ken, so much for having me. Next time, Edward Curtis. No, I'm kidding.
Right. That's a little bit of a private reference where Whitney had an interview where she was talking about women artists, and the interviewer just wanted to talk about a recent book about Edward Curtis, who gets enough press, I think.
So
we mentioned him just in passing.
Oh no, but thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with Whitney Otto, author of the new book, Art for the Ladylike, an autobiography through other lives from Ohio State University Press. You can find out more about Whitney, the new book, and all her work on her website, whitneyotto.com. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/between the covers, or just search for it on the KBOO website. KBOO, by the way, is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. To support the station and programming like this, there's no better time to become a member yourself or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the big donate button. All of us here at the station, thank you for that. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been a special edition of Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Whitney Otto for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening. I have